If you would please, go ahead and open your Bible to 2 Chronicles chapter 3, verse number 8. But also be ready to head over to 1 Kings chapter 7. We're currently doing our best to describe and imagine the majesty, the awesomeness of the temple built by Solomon, designed by David at the prompting of the Holy Spirit. The most expensive building per square foot, per cubic foot of any built in the history of the world, easily. We're talking about several trillions of dollars of material and an incalculable amount of labor, some of it very precise, skilled design work that took a total of about 7 years to do. And that doesn't even count the collecting of all the materials. So in 2 Chronicles, I want to look at verses 8 and 9 in chapter 3 because of some material, some information that was here that I forgot to pull in when we were describing the Holy of Holies, the most holy place, that 20 by 20 by 20 cube or cubic cube that is the throne room of God, the heart of the temple complex. And this is what it says, 2 Chronicles 3:8. He made the most holy place. Its length corresponding to the breadth of the house was 20 cubits. Its breadth was 20 cubits. Let me break in and remind you, its height was also 20 cubits. Now back to the text. He overlaid it with 600 talents of fine gold. That's 22.5 tons of gold that was used to overlay the woodwork of this interior cube, inside and out, of this special throne room for God. The weight of the gold for the nails was 50 shekels. Now, that's actually less than 2 pounds. So I don't think that's a description of the weight of all of the nails used in the construction of the most holy place, but rather that's the description of each individual nail that was used in framing this Holy of Holies. Because we're talking about some massive timbers and some pretty thick panels of cypress and of cedar wood, because these panels are going to be carved with imagery. So it's going to take a lot of lumber and pretty heavy-duty nails to hold all of that together. Now, these are described as being gold nails, but they may have, in fact, had an iron core or possibly even just an iron shank. Iron is twice as hard as gold, and so you would want the strength to hold the timbers and the paneling in place, but you'd kind of want gold to be what was showing once you pounded everything together. And then, of course, they overlaid everything with gold and then polished it up to a nice mirror finish. Now, there's something mentioned here that's not mentioned elsewhere. And verse number 9 finishes by saying, and he overlaid the upper chambers with gold. Because the interior dimensions of the temple building itself showed a height of 30 cubits. That's a height of just over 51 feet 9 inches. The Holy of Holies, though, is only 20 cubits tall. And so that leaves 10 cubits above the most holy place where these upper chambers, these upper rooms are located. Now, what are they for? More than likely, they are storage areas, possibly dedicated to the maintenance of the veil that hangs down in front of the Holy of Holies, because there's a mechanism for hanging it, a chain mechanism for hanging that veil in front of the interior shrine area. And so maybe this is what that's for up here, is access and storage for everything necessary for that maintenance. Now, that maintenance is going to be particularly important in the New Testament period, because the design of the main building itself of Zerubbabel's temple, which then was redone by Herod and becomes often referred to as Herod's temple, the design work was similar to this. And so there would have been an upper area, upper chambers, above the Holy of Holies of the temple of Jesus' day. And you remember that when Jesus died, the exact moment he gave up the ghost, God ripped this thick, decorative veil in half from top to bottom. And so that would have had to have been replaced. And so this area above the Holy of Holies is probably where that sort of work was carried on from. Now, I want us to go over to 1 Kings chapter 7 now. We're going to go outside of the shrine building, which we spent a lot of time talking about last session. But first, let's talk about the guy that's in charge of all the fine artisan work. 1 Kings 7:13. King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. Now, Hiram here is probably a slight spelling variation of what we saw earlier in 2 Chronicles 2:13, where the guy's name is Huram Abi. Verse 14, he was the son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali. Now, in 2 Chronicles 2:13, the woman, his mom, was listed as a daughter of Dan. So it's possible that she was, in fact, from the tribe of Dan, but married a man from the tribe of Naphtali first, and then after he died, she ends up marrying the next husband, which becomes the father of Hiram that we're talking about here, the Huram Abi, because in the continuation of verse 14, it says, his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. So we've got a half Israeli that is, he's grown up in Phoenicia, and he has been imparted by his Phoenician father, his Tyrian father, with great expertise in working with all sorts of material. In particular, bronze is listed here, but that's because of where we're going to go next in the text. It says, he was full of wisdom, understanding, and skill for making any work in bronze. And he came to King Solomon and did all his work. Now, bronze work was a specialty thing. And it was carried out by casting bronze in monstrous clay molds, which had to be out in open areas. And we'll talk about where this work was done in Israel in just a moment. In 1 Kings 7:15, it says that he cast two pillars of bronze. 18 cubits was the height of the one pillar, and so that's 33.05 feet. and that's the exact height for both pillars. But when we read in 2 Chronicles 3:15, it seems as if he cast these two pillars as one gigantic pillar to start with, and then cut it in half and made two matching pillars from that one gigantic tube. Because it says in 2 Chronicles 3:15, the front of the house, he made two pillars 35 cubits high. So that's roughly twice the height that we're talking about here. 36 would be closer to the perfect that we're talking about. This would not be a surprising way that he would do this. Make the one gigantic tube, slice it in half, and then have two matching tubes, because these things are hollow. Now, back to the 1 Kings passage. So he made two pillars of bronze. 18 cubits was the height of the one pillar, both pillars actually, 33.5 feet. The line of 12 cubits measured its circumference. So that's all around it, the perimeter of it. And that makes it 20.7 feet around. So you can tell that's big. The diameter, based on a mathematical formula, would be somewhere close to 4 cubits. It'd be 3.82 cubits if we want to be very precise about it. And that would be a diameter of 6.589 feet. Now, I think the precision may not have been there in these things, because we've also got the issue of its thickness. And it says that it was hollow and its thickness was 4 fingers. That's roughly 3 inches. It's the measurement across your 4 fingers, right there where your pinky finger is at level with all the others. All right, so the second pillar was the same. So it's a matched set. Then he made two capitals of cast bronze to set on the tops of the pillars. So the bronze pillars are giving the height to this decoration, or these decorations. And then up at the top of them, there's going to be a cap on them, a capital, that is also going to be very decorative and draw the eye upward. And these capitals are massive. They're 5 cubits tall. The height of the one was 5 cubits, the height of the other, 5 cubits. And so 5 cubits is 8.625 feet. And since we know that these pillars are roughly 6 feet in diameter, they are nice and wide and nice and tall to draw the eye up to the tower that is going to be above them. Because remember, there's this 120-cubit, 207-foot tower that is above the entry point to the shrine building. Now, verse 17, there were lattices of checkerwork with wreaths of chainwork for the capitals on the tops of the pillars, a lattice for the one capital and a lattice for the other capital. Now, there's a lot of different thinkings about what this is all about. I'm going to give you my opinion. I believe this is an anti-bird device that was intended to be very beautiful. I think the lattice work that we're talking about here is some sort of chain work. And that this was then wrapped around the capitals and strung across between the two capitals to discourage birds coming in and roosting or nesting in the decorative work of these capitals. Because all of us know one of the worst things that happens in ancient buildings is the birds get up in these decorative capital nooks and crannies, and they sit there and they poop everywhere, and it makes a big mess. Well, this may have been Huram Abi's solution to that, to just put a fine net, fine chain work that you'd still be able to see through from down below, but to discourage the birds from coming in there. That, just my suggestion, all right? Verse number 18, back to the decorative work of all this. Likewise, he made pomegranates in two rows around the one lattice work to cover the capital that was at the top of the pillar, and he did the same with the other capital. Pomegranates were often made as decorations in sacred things. For example, on the hem of the high priest's uniform, there were bells interspersed with little pomegranate pom-poms. And this allowed the high priest to kind of jingle and tingle whenever he was going around doing his work. But also, the motion of the little pomegranates down there at the bottom gave a beauty to his moving around. So here we've got pomegranates that have apparently become part of this net, this webbing that I think is an anti-bird device. Verse number 19. Now the capitals that were on the top of the pillars in the vestibule were of lily work, 4 cubits. Now, we just read a moment ago that these capitals are 5 cubits tall, but the lily work of them is only 4 cubits. That is only about 6.9 feet in height. So what more than likely is happening here is that the lily flower, the massive lily flower decoration, sits on the top of each pillar. And on top of the lily is probably some sort of square platform that then butts up against the bottom of the tower that shoots up above this entry porch to the shrine building. Because the whole idea is to have a highly decorative entry point into the shrine building. And so you've got these two massive bronze pillars with their beautiful caps to them, their beautiful capitals. And then above that goes up the big tower up into the sky. Verse number 20. The capitals were on the two pillars and also above the rounded projection, which was beside the lattice work. And there were 200 pomegranates in one row all around, and so with the other capital. And he set up the two pillars at the vestibule of the temple. And he set up the pillar on the south, and he called it Yakin. So that's the one, if you're facing the entry of the temple, that would be on the left side. But if you're standing on the porch facing outward, it would be on your right-hand side. And then he set up the pillar on the north, and he called it Boaz. Now, that's important, I think, because later we discover that the kings of Judah, the kings of Israel, took their oath of office, so to say, their vow to serve God, standing between these two pillars. And so from their perspective, as they faced the crowd of people gathered in the front of the temple, the right-hand pillar for them would have been Yakin, and the left-hand pillar would have been Boaz. And together, their names form a sentence from right to left. Yakin, he shall establish, Boaz, in strength. So the king's ordination would have been completely focused on the idea that the throne of the king of Israel was established in strength by God, whose temple he stood in front of when he took his oath of office. So I think that's very, very important. Now, verse 22. On the tops of the pillars was lily work, and thus the work of the pillars was finished. Now we're ready to move eastward from the porch, forward, down some steps to the next item, which is the sea of cast metal. Verse 23. Then he made the sea of cast metal. It was round, 10 cubits from brim to brim, 5 cubits high, and a line of 30 cubits measured its circumference. All right, so let's talk about these dimensions. It's formed like a half hemisphere. Excuse me. It's formed like half of a sphere, so a hemisphere, like a big bowl. And it's 10 cubits across. So that's 17.25 feet across. It's 5 cubits high. And so it's 8.625 feet tall. And if you measure around it, the circumference at some place, that's 30 cubits. So 51.75 feet. Now, some people who don't particularly like the Bible, I'm afraid, have criticized this passage because those measurements don't provide an entirely precise relationship between the diameter that we're given and the circumference that we're given. But I'm not bothered by that, and I think it's unjustified because the precision that we seem to be giving in the measurements here are simply rounded to the closest half cubit. And such a criticism doesn't take in consideration where do you measure that diameter? Does it take in consideration the thickness of this big bowl, which is given next? Verse 24, under its brim were gourds for 10 cubits, compassing the sea all around. And the gourds were in 10 rows, cast with it when it was cast. So it has this decorative brim all around it, which might have come into the diameter measurement. And it was cast as one monstrous piece of bronze. Now we're not done yet. This big pool, this big water tank, that's what it actually is. Verse 25, it stood on 12 oxen, 3 facing north, 3 facing west, 3 facing south, and 3 facing east. So how many is that? 12. And that represents the 12 tribes of Israel, maybe the 12 months of the year, possibly even the 12 zodiac signs which the sun passed through every single year and helped the Israelis keep their calendars in line. So these oxen seem to be life-size, and they provide the decorative platform on which this monster water tank sits. Now, were there spigot mechanisms? Possibly so, because the water is to be used for ceremonial washing throughout the day. And this tank would have been filled up constantly through the day, either by a bucket brigade or by some sort of tube system that would have filled it to keep it constantly full of water that could be used. Now, verse number 26 says, its thickness was a handbreadth. So there we go with at least 3 inches again, how thick this great big tank was. And its brim was like the brim of a cup, like the flower of a lily. So it kind of curved around and underneath. And of course, we had all those decorations that went with that. Now here we're told that it held 2,000 baths. Now a bath is a measurement of volume, liquid volume that the Israelis used. Roughly, we're talking about here, 13,960 gallons would be 2,000 baths. So that's a lot of water. And we have a variation in the Second Chronicles 4:5 passage, because there it says that this tank could hold 3,000 baths. And that's over 20,000, almost 21,000 gallons. Now, what's the difference between those two? How come we've got 2,000 one place and 3,000 the other? Well, it's possible that scribal errors might account for that, where somebody copied the wrong number at the beginning of the 1,000 indicator. But it's also possible, and I actually kind of like this one better, that the 2,000 baths represents the nominal level of water, while the 3,000 baths describes the absolute maximum amount of water that it could hold. You probably would never fill it all the way up to the brim. You would instead keep the water level somewhat below the brim, especially if you were constantly filling it with a bucket brigade or some sort of piping system. Well, we're kind of out of time for today. So when we come back tomorrow, we'll talk about how the temple needed portable water tanks as well. Not just simply this massive reservoir. They needed to be able to bring water to all sides of the shrine building to be able to do all the sacrificial ritual washings that they needed to do.